Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. Thanks for joining us for another installment of our Spaced Learning Series, in which we revisit schemas previously discussed on the podcast. I'm super excited to be here with my close friends, Jack and Steph.
What's up, team? I'm super stoked to be back with you all today. I think we have a great case in store, and I'm really excited to hear you guys talk through it.
Yeah. Jack, I just realized that we're matching.
Oh, we do. We do. We are looking active. For those of you listening, which is everybody to this podcast episode right now, Steph and I are both wearing black Nike tops, which means that we are ready to probably sweat through this case a little bit. Hopefully Steph more than I do, but I do get a little bit nervous with public speaking. So who knows?
Thanks, guys. I didn't get the memo. Jeez.
All right. Are you guys ready to get things going here?
Let's do it.
All right. So you're called to the ED to evaluate a 58-year-old woman with hypertension, diabetes, and hyperlipidemia who's presenting with 2 weeks of progressive malaise and 5 days of diffuse abdominal pain. The pain is dull, achy, crampy, and while it is worst in the epigastric and periumbilical areas, she feels it all over. She's also had progressive nausea and vomiting for the last 2 days and hasn't been able to keep down any liquids or solids. This morning, she felt dizzy and lightheaded, which is what prompted her to come to the ER today. Her review of systems is otherwise notable for chills and some mild shortness of breath. She hasn't taken her temperature at home. She doesn't have any chest pain, cough, night sweats, or weight loss. She's been passing gas and last had a bowel movement the day before presentation.
Okay, friends. Well, here we have a 58-year-old woman presenting with subacute generalized abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. I was taught in an early part of my medical training in medical school to not only one, respect abdominal pain, but two, also recognize that the abdomen is a big black box. A lot of things can happen in the abdomen, from benign to life-threatening, and a lot of non-abdominal pathologies can also cause pain to the abdomen, such as myocardial infarction, DKA, and adrenal insufficiency. And there are so many ways to categorize abdominal pain, and each approach, I think, helps us in a different way. For example, chronologically, is it acute, subacute, or chronic? Acute abdominal pain prompts us to think of visceral perforation, ischemia, or luminal obstruction, or it can suggest intra-abdominal catastrophes, such as torsion, ectopic pregnancy, vascular dissection, or hemorrhage. And when the abdominal pain is subacute to chronic, or if the patient reports localizing pain, an anatomic approach may be helpful. So we separate the abdomen roughly into the right upper quadrant, right lower quadrant, epigastrium, periumbilical region, suprapubic, left upper quadrant, and left lower quadrant. And these sections of the abdomen tend to correlate with the underlying structures in the abdomen. Remember our reproductive organs, such as the ovaries, fallopian tubes, and uterus. Missing ovarian torsion, ectopic, or even a uterine pregnancy could be catastrophic. Don't forget about structures that can also hypertrophy in the abdomen, outgrowing its vascular supply or even causing compression. This includes organomegaly, cancer, or significant lymphadenopathy. Using modifiers can help us suss out which organs may be involved in the abdominal pain. For example, is the pain related to food intake? Pain relating to food can clue us into issues with the integrity of the luminal GI tract, or perhaps the gallbladder or pancreas. The presence of diarrhea helps us localize to the luminal GI tract. And the presence of jaundice would make us pay special attention to the biliary tract. And finally, a brand new concept that I learned specifically from CP Solvers is the concept of image negative abdominal pain. There are inflammatory states in the abdomen that either may not show up on CT imaging or perhaps don't exist in the abdomen at all, but just refers pain there. For the sake of time, I will leave you with that lingering thought and encourage you to think of your own causes of and review the schema we have for image negative abdominal pain. All of this is just to say that there isn't just one approach that works. Abdominal pain requires strategic, stepwise history taking at the bedside, targeted exam, labs and imaging, and often serial examinations or follow-up.
I love it, Steph. I mean, I think it highlights so well how massive of a topic abdominal pain is. And what we really have to do is sort of tease apart these different qualifiers, like the tempo, the localization, and then also some of the associated symptoms. So hopefully I'll give you some information that can help you all tease apart some of the rest of the details here. A little bit more about her in the case is she takes lisinopril. She has skipped the last 2 days due to nausea. She also takes atorvastatin and metformin. She lives in San Francisco with her family, no recent travel or known sick contacts, including no known exposures to those with COVID-19. On exam, she had a temperature of 99.6, a heart rate of 132, and a blood pressure of 98/62 on arrival, and that subsequently fell to 84/56 in the emergency department. She had a respiratory rate of 22 breaths per minute and was sitting 93% on room air. On exam, she was uncomfortable, ill-appearing, and tachypneic. Her JVP was elevated to about 10 centimeters. She was tachycardic, no murmurs, rubs, or gallop, and was tachypneic with clear lungs on exam. She had a diffusely tender abdomen without rebound or guarding. She had cool extremities and 1+ pitting edema to her knees. Her mental status and neurologic exams were both normal. In terms of labs, she had a neutrophil predominant leukocytosis to 12, a new anemia of 9 from 12 6 months prior, and an acute kidney injury with a creatinine of 1.5 from a baseline of 0.8. Her lactate was 7.2.
Wow, there's so much to discuss, but maybe I'll start just by kind of focusing on the combination of this lactic acid and hypotension. This initially is going to make me think of the clinical syndrome of shock, which refers to impaired utilization or delivery of oxygen to the peripheral tissues. Now, broadly speaking, we can think about shock as being either any of one of four causes: hypovolemic, cardiogenic, obstructive, or distributive. When they do the trials, I know the vasopressor trials, they looked at all comers of shock. And in those trials, the most common causes were distributive shock, with septic shock kind of leading the way. And that certainly fits with my experience during residency. But there's features of this case that make that less likely. Specifically, I'm honing in on this patient's elevated JVP and cold extremities. Now, both of those are going to make me more concerned about either a cardiogenic or obstructive cause of shock. In both of these scenarios, cardiac output is reduced and the peripheral vascular resistance is high, hence the cold extremities. Now, this is in contrast to distributive shock, where you might expect the patient to be vasodilated and therefore warm. Or if you have hypovolemic shock, you probably wouldn't see that elevated JVP. So how do we make progress here at the bedside? One useful tool is point of care ultrasonography. This is something that I'm still trying to work on getting better at, just because of how useful it can be. You can use this to answer discrete dichotomized questions like, is there a pericardial effusion? Is there an absence of lung sliding to suggest a pneumothorax? Or does the LV function seem to be globally reduced or roughly normal? And we would argue for caution in not putting too much stock in this unless you have sufficient expertise or experience in interpreting your images. So certainly it's always good to have somebody, at least early on in our training, kind of double check our work with this before we make major clinical decisions on it.
I love it, Dan. I think what stands out there is you're highlighting the fact that diagnosis, yes, it is about analysis of the data that we have, but there's also this other huge component of it, which is how do we prioritize our decisions and how do we use the tools that we have available to us, whether it's exam or augmenting our exam with things like a bedside ultrasound. So here's some more data for you all. We have we had an EKG that showed sinus tachycardia was otherwise normal. She had a chest X-ray that showed clear lungs and an enlarged cardiomediastinal silhouette, and her troponin was slightly elevated at around 0.6. Her bedside ultrasound showed a plump, minimally collapsing IVC and a very large pericardial effusion.
Wow. So in this example, the point of care ultrasound was key augmentation to this person's physical exam. I don't know about you guys, Jack and Dan, but when I think of pericardial effusion, and especially if there's a large pericardial effusion, but even when I see small to moderate ones, my mind races to whether management needs to proceed diagnosis. I often look at the patient's vital signs with attention to their heart rate and blood pressure, and I think about whether this patient's accumulated pericardial fluid has reached the limit of exceeding the pericardial stretch, which may lead to tamponade if not intervened. To echo, you see what I did there? To echo what Dan said, Before, given this patient's vitals and physical exam, it appears that she is in cardiogenic shock or obstructive shock due to tamponade physiology and needs emergent confirmatory diagnosis and management. maybe it's a good time for us to update our problem representation in preparation to call a consult. We have a 58-year-old woman presenting with subacute malaise and generalized abdominal pain, found to be in cardiogenic shock with a large pericardial effusion on bedside ultrasound concerning for tamponade.
All right. So we started a bolus of IV fluids and Paige, the cardiology fellow, because we were thinking along the exact same lines as you were, Dan and Steph. While they were on their way, we checked for a pulsus paradoxus at the bedside, and it was elevated at 16.
Wow. I cannot believe that the Jack Penner is having me describe the pulsus paradoxus. This is something he taught me how to do way back when we were interns at the San Francisco VA hospital. So, you know, I'll try and do my best, but maybe Jack can you know, chime in if he's got other comments. You know, at its base, the pulsus paradoxus, it's the difference in systolic blood pressure between inspiration and expiration. So to understand this, I'm going to, you know, take a page out of Robbie's book and let's follow the path of blood through the heart and think about the different pressures. I'm going to like skip the meditative portion of this, but you know, you imagine blood just kind of coming from the superior and inferior vena cavae into the right side of the heart before going through the pulmonary circulation and ending up on the left side of the heart. When you inspire, your intrathoracic pressure is going to become more negative and it's going to bring more blood into the right side of the heart. You know, most of the time, the right ventricle, it's pretty distensible, so it can expand to accommodate this extra amount of blood. Yet, in certain circumstances, the ability of the RV to expand outward and accommodate this blood is reduced. You know, this may occur in something like constrictive pericarditis, or if there's a significant pericardial effusion that limits outward RV expansion. So, if you bring more blood to the right side of the heart during inspiration, and the RV cannot dilate to accommodate it, where does this blood go? You know, if the RV can't go outward, then it must expand inward. In doing so, it displaces the septum into the cavity of the left ventricle. As a result, the LV stroke volume diminishes and you get a transient reduction in left-sided cardiac output. And we'd use a cutoff of about 10 millimeters of mercury between inspiration and expiration to define a pathological pulsus paradoxus, I remember Jack talking about it, and you can see his Twitter legacy on this, the pulsus exaggeratus. Since, you know, a small amount of difference between inspiratory and expiratory cardiac output can occur in normal circumstances. So really it becomes a problem when that is exaggerated or pulsus exaggeratus, as Jack says.
I have nothing to add. I will just give you some more clinical data here. In the last episode, we talked about how Dan is eosinophilic and he has indeed turned me eosinophilic with blushing from this one. That one is for you, Charmaine. It happened every podcast episode. I think we're 5 for 5 so far. Excellent. All right.
Everybody should go out there and see Jack's Twitter. It's amazing. He has an amazing tutorial on this.
Moving on. The cardiology fellow performed an echo that revealed diastolic collapse of the right atrium and the RV free wall. She was taken urgently to the cath lab and underwent a pericardial drain placement. Upon placement of the drain, about 900 cc's of bloody fluid was drained.
Whoa, that's a lot of fluid to come out of the pericardial space. So to contextualize, I tell some of my interns to imagine this, but imagine 1 liter of fluid as the equivalent of 3 cans of soda. You got to wonder where all this fluid is coming from. Now that this patient has undergone pericardiocentesis, I think it's a good time for us to think about the causes of pericardial effusions. A pericardial effusion can accumulate rapidly or gradually, and the size of the effusion combined with the hemodynamic consequence can help us to estimate the chronicity, and that can sometimes give us a hint as to the underlying cause. For example, a very large effusion with no hemodynamic consequence likely has accumulated slowly over weeks to allow the pericardium to stretch and adapt, whereas a small or moderate effusion from which a patient is in tamponade or shock has likely accumulated quickly over minutes to days. Causes for pericardial effusions include infectious pericarditis like viral, bacterial, mycobacterial, fungal, autoimmune or inflammatory related, such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, malignancy, post-MI, post-cardiac procedure, such as cardiac surgery, device placement, or even chest compressions. And very rarely, effusions can also be caused by uremia, hypothyroidism, or radiation. The most common causes of pericardial effusions with high incidence of progression to tamponade include bacterial, fungal, and HIV-associated infections, bleeding, such as in the case of a hemopericardium post-cardiac procedure, and malignancy. And in places where it's endemic, tuberculosis is a common cause of pericardial effusion.
Pearls on pearls here. I'm very glad that I get to be listening to you all here. So some more information, some of the tests that we ran off of the pericardial fluid now that she has stabilized. She had a cell count that demonstrated a lymphocytic predominant leukocytosis. Her Gram stain, AFB, and fungal smears were negative, as was an ADA level. She then underwent CT of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis with notable findings that included diffuse intra-abdominal, mediastinal, and cervical lymphadenopathy, and no masses were seen.
What are you thinking, Steph? I think this is our final opportunity here.
Well, first I'm thinking like, whoa, it took a long time to get the CT of the chest and pelvis. And I think that's because she was like in tamponade physiology, but I think this is where the meat of our differential is happening here. I think we're going to be able to probably make the diagnosis based on her CT abdomen pelvis findings of diffuse intra-abdominal, mediastinal, and cervical lymphadenopathy.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that you set us up well with the discussion of pericardial effusion being, you know, likely infection, autoimmune, malignant, kind of the amazing triad of internal medicine. And now we have some, a different schema that we can kind of pull up with the diffuse lymphadenopathy. And really that sort of argues for either some, you know, malignancy kind of is the highest of the list, either liquid or solid, or certain infections and autoimmune diseases can do it. But, you know, I think this pattern of really bulky lymphadenopathies making me pretty concerned for some sort of malignancy going on. And I think that would be a compelling area of overlap. The only other thing I'll mention is like the lymphocytic nature of the fluid, I think argues against a pyogenic bacterial infection. So maybe that pushes us more towards malignancy at this point, but I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, totally. I kind of wonder, Jack didn't tell us, but I honestly don't know the answer to this question, but how often can a malignancy be diagnosed based on like a pericardial effusion and cytology of that effusion? I'm wondering if that effusion would give us a diagnosis or if we'll need to have like a good biopsy of one of these lymph nodes to look at the underlying core structures.
It's such a good question, Steph. I wish that in preparing the case, I had looked it up, but I will utter three of the best words, which is that I don't know. What I can tell you is that in this case, the pericardial fluid cytology and flow cytometry were negative. She underwent an excisional lymph node biopsy that showed abnormal architecture, atypical CD20 positive lymphocytes, and was ultimately diagnosed with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. For follow-up, I actually got to speak with this patient recently after they have now completed chemotherapy and are having a really good treatment response and overall doing quite well. Positive outcome from what was a really terrifying triage and decision-making process. And before turning it over to you, we'll offer one other reflection around, I think in solving these cases or talking through these cases in this setting, like oftentimes we are sort of working to stretch ourselves and to stretch our knowledge. And I think a huge part of this case was knowing like when the stretch is coming too far and when to sort of start to call and ask for help. And I think in this case, reaching out to the cardiology fellow and also how quickly the cardiology fellow got there was a huge part of getting this patient to where she needed to go. Cause things were starting to turn quick. And so, I'm glad that we can all talk about it and sort of push the boundaries of our knowledge here, and was incredibly grateful, for the team who kind of rushed to, stabilize this patient so that we could even get to the point to talking about some of the diagnostic testing.
Jack, I had, a patient on service once before with a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who just needed like recurrent thoracentesis and paracentesis for reaccumulation of fluid. I don't know how long you took care of this patient, but did the pericardial effusion kind of reaccumulate? And she sounds like she had a drain. And what was your experience in controlling that fluid?
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised at how long the drain stayed in and how long the drain continued to have fluid. I don't remember what happened with the drain, but I think the patient eventually had the drain taken out, but not after days to even, I think, a week or more, just until the fluid stopped draining. So I think it's a good reminder, Steph, of like, we do these things, but then like, what is the 5-day forecast or the 5-week forecast for what's going to end up happening after these decisions? But yeah, that's a great pro. And yeah, I just remember, like, I think I was so in awe of the fellow and just the way that she was able to like, not only like hold the space and sort of like handle things and get people going to where they need to go, but also the way in which she was able to like control the emotional energy of the room. Cause I was like very activated and very stressed out. And I think after the fact, you realize that like so much of this process of teaching and managing patients comes down to those human factors. And in this case, like I learned so much from her and how she handled that acute scenario. So hopefully there was learning that that was had today. And yeah, thank you all so much for tuning in. And Dan and Steph, it's always such a pleasure. Thanks for yucking it up today.
Well, thank you, Jack. That was a blast talking about this case. Thanks so much for preparing it.
Really awesome case. See you later.
See you next time.
Take care.
That's a wrap, folks.